Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Do random bits of paper pile up at your house? Think twice before tossing them in the trash.
Even if you don't want them, identity thieves will.
That's our reporter Lisa Napoli with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. She says certain papers may be junk to you, but they're pure gold to scammers.
Even if you don't want them, identity thieves will.
So what kind of paper should you dispose of with care? Is it A, pay stubs? Some have your address and social security number printed right on them. Or are we talking B, credit card solicitations? Thieves use them to get a shiny new card with your name on it. Or is it C, old tax forms? You really should hold on to those for your records anyway, folks. Stumped? The answer is just minutes away on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
Pre-approved credit line, zero interest on balance transfers. Sick of all those credit card solicitations? So are we. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
A few years ago, my husband and I had our first of three brushes with identity theft. We got a $6,000 bill for a credit card we didn't own. We're pretty sure the thief just grabbed out of the trash one of the dozens of pre-approved credit card offers we used to receive and used it to open the card. Now we're on a list that removes us from the modern scourge of multiple card offers, but a colleague here at Marketplace hasn't done that just yet. This week, Lisa Napoli took a closer look at her mail and tried to make sense of it.
For about 2 months now, I've been saving all my credit card offers. The other day, for dramatic effect, I opened them all up at once. In this thick stack of paper, I tallied up offer after offer of vast fortunes, or at least the modern equivalent. Lots of chances to consolidate credit cards at really low interest rates. Lots of companies offering me tons of frequent flyer miles and no annual fee. If only I'd accept their cards.
The tools to give you control. The Sky Miles to send you on vacation.
Home equity loans for six figures, even though I don't own a home anymore. Then there were the sweet offers to share the wealth, like...
Every day you give so much to your loved ones, your time and expertise, your care and concern. Now you can give them something more.
Now, not only am I not going to give someone I love a credit card, I try not to use them myself, and I pay them off right away when I do. And credit expert Jason Rich says that's why I'm a target.
The credit card companies want you to sign up for their credit cards, and they want you to sign up for as many credit cards as possible because that's how they make money. Basically, the average American gets somewhere between 5 and 12 or more credit card offers every single week.
Rich says these companies are hoping I'll want the card so I have the plastic ready for the day I fall into a cash crunch, or the time I decide I just have to have that plasma television, whether or not I have the money. And so the credit companies wine and dine me.
You're being offered the very best deals these credit card companies offer. So you're going to have no annual fee offers. You're going to have very low interest rates. Plus, they're going to offer you really good perks like the frequent flyer miles and a large number of them.
Let's be clear. There's nothing special about me. Someone with below average credit is going to get just as many offers as I do, just not as generous. But flattery and freebies can get you anywhere. Bob Manning is the author of Credit Card Nation, and he sees how foolish consumers can be.
People, do they take out their calculators and look at their line of credit and actually then factor in what their cost of doing the transaction is, and then compare it to their current APR, and do they really understand what their cost savings are? No, of course not.
Manning says do the math if you're enticed by what a company dangles to lure you in. For instance, figure out if there's a balance transfer rate for consolidating cards and when it kicks in. A lower interest rate might not compensate for any penalty the company might charge. And Jason Rich says be careful how often you apply for a credit card, because if you get rejected, that's a mark against you that will linger on your credit score for months. He says if you decide you need more credit, it's better for you to go after the credit card rather than to let the credit card go after you.
There are actually a bunch of websites that you can go to that actually compare all of the different credit card offers from the different banks. You'll fill out like a 5-question questionnaire. Is this for a balance transfer? Are you looking for a 0 annual fee? And then they'll give you what they think are the 10 best offers.
Just be careful the sites aren't ones that are paid for by the banks themselves. Rich recommends Bankrate.com, CreditRatings.com, and CreditCards.com. And he reminds you to watch what you do with your mail. Remember to shred all those offers you get, because even if you don't want them, identity thieves will. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at nasdfoundation.org.
Well, we just heard all about Lisa Napoli's ordeal with credit cards. You might be thinking to yourself, I'll just avoid those hassles by swiping something else, a debit card. No interest to worry about, no solicitations in the mail. What's the worst thing that can happen from using them? Well, you don't track your spending and run out of money. But that's not all. Jillian Mincer is with Dow Jones Newswires. Jillian, what's the biggest risk you're taking by using debit instead of credit?
They don't offer the same protections that you get when you use a credit card. And a lot varies depending on what kind of card you have, what bank you get it through, and also how you use it.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that when you use it at, say, one of those terminals where you swipe your card and it asks you debit or credit, that you should actually type in credit even if you're using your debit card.
Exactly. One of the biggest problems is people assume because it looks like a credit card that it offers the same protections. And as we know, the federal laws say that on a credit card, you are protected if someone else uses your card illegally. You're responsible for only $50 in purchases. Whereas with debit cards, those responsibilities get higher if the card is used fraudulently.
You also mentioned in the story that, for example, if you're using your card to make a hotel reservation or a car rental reservation, that that money actually comes right out of your account to hold the reservation. And that's not something that maybe you want to do with your debit card.
That is one of the problems with a debit card. If you have a reservation and you use your debit card and perhaps you're expecting to stay at this hotel at $100 a day for 7 days, that'll be $700. It'll block out that $700. And while you might have $700 in your account when you actually go to that hotel, it could possibly make you bounce a check if you don't have the money in the account when you make the reservation. While you might get your money back, It could take several days, and during that time, you could be bouncing checks or you might not have access to any cash.
Well, frankly, I use my debit card all the time, but I'm wondering now if I want to do that. What can I do to make sure that this doesn't happen to me?
A lot of people like using a debit card because it does keep track of your expenses. Instead of, you know, getting money out of the ATM machine and not having any at the end of the week or midweek, you know exactly where you spent it. That said, one of the best things to do is find out what safety mechanisms are in place that your bank provides. What exactly are you going to be responsible? Because different banks offer different things. And then when you're using your debit card, always keep your receipts, always review your statements, and check your balances regularly. A lot of banks will set it up so that you could get text messaging or an email message if your account goes below a certain amount, and that's a good warning sign. Also, believe it or not, a lot of people carry around their PIN number, which is a very dangerous thing to do.
I mean, like written out?
Yes.
In their wallet?
In their wallet. It's very common.
Okay, people don't do that.
Definitely don't do that. Because if someone gets your wallet and they have their PIN number, it's gone.
Jillian Mincer is a personal finance columnist with Dow Jones Newswires. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Yes, that may be true, but here at Marketplace Money, summer school's in session. This week, we're looking at Wall Street's quarterly report card, also known as earnings. But they're not exactly like the report cards you brought home from school back in the day. The Marketplace players present this dramatization of how even the best corporate earnings can prompt a stock to tank.
Hey, Mom! Dad! It's report card day!
Well, it must be good news.
Let's see here. Straight A's?
Yep.
You're grounded.
What?
You think you're getting into Harvard with grades like these? Put some pluses next to those A's, then we'll talk.
But this is enough to get me a scholarship to Berkeley.
Berkeley?
Berkeley. You call that a school?
No matter what I do, it's never enough.
Is it wrong to have high expectations for you?
Look what you're doing to your mother. Go to your room.
You're tearing me apart.
I said go.
I don't have a son.
And now for a real definition. At the blackboard today, economist Chris Lowe.
Earnings are the profits made by a company, and they're reported in an individual quarter. It's the way we keep track of how well a company is doing. After all, in a capitalist system, profits are the bottom line. It's the ultimate measure of success. The difference between actual reported earnings and expected earnings is, in fact, probably the most important thing from an investor's point of view. And the reason is that earnings are only reported once a quarter, which means for the rest of that three-month period, investors are buying and selling the stock in anticipation of future earnings. As those future earnings are reported, we compare them to what was expected. If they fall short, then the stock is going to sell off and will readjust. If, on the other hand, they outperform, well, then the stock's probably going to go up. As an investor, it's probably a good idea not to worry too much if earnings are slightly off of expectations. A penny up or a penny down isn't going to make a big difference in the long run. It's probably more important to go through earnings reports, listen to investor conference calls, and try and judge whether there's future for the company, whether the prospects for earnings in the future is positive or negative, and also whether the excuses, because there always will be excuses, are good ones when a company falls short.
Our teacher this week was Chris Lowe. He's the chief economist with FTN Financial in New York. Next week, we go house shopping and ask, what exactly is PMI? Listeners, start your engines. A high-octane mailbag is ready to go. Chris does the speed round. And we take a bike ride through the mean streets of Amsterdam.
Most of the times, the people themselves are not hurt so badly, but in some cases, the bike is completely ruined.
A day in the work life of a bike mechanic. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Vig-Lund. This weekend, bike mania grips Europe. The world's best cyclists have gathered for the Tour de France. But there's one European city where bikers are king all year long, Amsterdam in the Netherlands. 740,000 people live there, and they own 600,000 bikes. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a guy who helps them keep rolling.
Tightening the chain, actually, what I'm doing now. Well, maintained bicycles shouldn't make any noise. Almost nothing. My name is Wim. I'm a bicycle mechanic, and I'm the owner of this shop. I got involved in the bicycle business because I owned one of these big three-wheel bikes with a box that you use here for transporting. I always did the maintenance on that one myself, and so I wanted to know more about it. Actually, there is a school here in Amsterdam for bicycle mechanics. It's a two-year education. Now I got my exam, and I'm also a teacher. The most typical problem with bicycles in Amsterdam, well, bicycles need to be parked outside because the houses here are very small and there is no storage inside. And that means that the bicycles endure a lot from the weather conditions, and I think that's basically most things that we do is cables that rust, bikes that fall over and something is bent, flat tires. An accident! That's also one of the typical things from Amsterdam. Here we have streetcars and they ride over a rail which is embedded in the middle of the streets, and if you get caught with your front wheel in these rails, your wheel suddenly makes a move in a direction you're not suspecting, and then you just trip over your handlebars and then you're face down on the street, and that can be very, very painful. Most of the times the people themselves are not hurt so badly, because otherwise they wouldn't be here, but in some cases the bike is completely ruined. On a quiet day it can be as less as 10 bicycles that I repair. On a busy day, it can be up to 35, 40 bikes that I have to repair on one day. Standard repairs are done within 10, 15 minutes, so then you can do quite a lot in a day. But respoking a wheel will cost you about half an hour. Restoring old bikes, you can be working on one bicycle a whole day. I used to work 3 days a week, and that paid me about 1,500 euros every month, about $2,000. And at the moment, this is my own shop, so if I need some cash, I just grab it. Generally, between $20,000 and $30,000 a year. Why are bikes such an important way of transport in Amsterdam? Well, it's because the way the city is designed. It's quite a small city. I actually call it the largest village in Europe. In half an hour, you're from downtown to the outskirts of Amsterdam. It's the fastest way, it's the cheapest way. You have no parking problems. Everywhere there are racks where you can park your bicycle. And it keeps you fit, of course. And it's fun. I have absolutely no interest in cars. I don't even have a driver's license. I don't need one. Perfect.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
An exposed housing scam brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, equity stripping. Equity stripping is a con that tempts cash-strapped homeowners. The strippers say they'll refinance the owner's homes, give them cash, lower their payments, and let them keep their house. But in reality, the dirty dancer takes over the deed and borrows as much as possible against the house's value. And the owner loses their home. Regulators worry there will be more victims falling for equity stripping, so many states have passed laws against it. Because this routine is definitely obscene. Got a box full of letters.
Thinking my right to read. Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's that time on the show when our very own Doctor of Debt, our Surgeon of Securities, Chris Farrell, answers all your financial questions. Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Okay. Well, our first caller lives not too far away from our own downtown L.A. studio. Malcolm is calling from Lawndale, California. How are you, Malcolm?
I'm okay. It'll come as a complete surprise, but I'm not American. I'm a Brit. And I'm an ex-Londoner, in fact. But I'm very proud to say that as of 2 months ago, I'm now a U.S. permanent resident.
Bravo.
And I've got my own little Social Security card and a shiny new green card.
Be sure not to hand out that Social Security card because that could get you in big ID theft trouble.
This is what those nice people at the Social Security people told me. They said, do not carry it with you in big letters on their letter. And yep. They've been lecturing me to the same extent.
Well, so you know how to do that. Tell us what your question is for Chris.
I've just been turned down for a credit card by a very big credit card company because we must tell you that you do not have a history of a revolving credit record. Well, I wrote back to them saying, how do I get a credit history in 10 weeks, revolving or otherwise? And they haven't answered me yet, so they're thinking about it perhaps.
So if you're an immigrant, how do you start building credit right away?
The classic way to do it is to get a gasoline credit card. You know, every time you go to the pump, you use it, pay it off, end of the month, you build your credit history. Or you go to a store. Stores are always giving out credit cards, often, you know, 10% off on the purchase that you're doing. So a retail credit card is often easy to get. You start using it. That's how you build credit. If you're still running into trouble, there's still some other ways to go about it. One, I don't know, Malcolm, you like to exercise? Do you go to the health club?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well, find out. Does your health club report your payments to the credit bureaus?
Oh,
most do. And you are automatically, every time you're lifting weights or you're doing your running on that exercise machine, you are also building up a credit history. And then the simple way to do it is to go to whatever bank you're using and you say, okay, here I've got $500 or I have $1,000, whatever amount of money you have is in a savings account. Give me a secured credit card against that savings account. So I have a $500 limit or I have a $1,000 limit. You use that secured credit card for a period of time, a year, and then you go back to the bank and you say, hey, I'm good. I paid it off every time. Give me an unsecured credit card, your classic, and they'll give you it.
Oh, I see. Unsecured as opposed to secured.
Most people listening to this program, you know, you pull out your wallet, you got your Visa, your MasterCard. That's an unsecured credit card. It's just based on faith that you're going to pay it back. A secured credit card has dollars right behind it in that savings account.
Let me ask you a simple, silly question. What does a credit rating actually provide them? What is it saying?
What it says is that you're a person that pays back your debts on time. The credit rating then becomes important because that determines what interest rate you're going to borrow and how available is the credit.
All right, Malcolm, I hope that was helpful for you.
Very, very helpful indeed. And thank you very much to both of you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, we've got a special segment of Mailbag today, which we like to call it the speed round, because we're about to answer five of our commonly asked questions in 5 minutes. 5 and 5. Are you ready for this, Chris?
I am absolutely ready. This will be fun.
All right. Well, we've been doing some stretches, some sprints, and Chris has been keeping himself hydrated. As for me, I'm lacing up my shoes and setting my clock.
Now, Tess, I have to tell you, in high school, I did the high hurdles. I had beautiful form, but I usually came in last.
And today, how's your form?
Hopefully, it'll be a lot better. I think I can do better with the questions.
Okay. Well, before we start, please take down our website address. It's marketplace.org and click on the contact button there. Or you can give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. All right. You ready? We're on the blocks.
Okay. All right.
Ready?
Let's get ready to rumble!
Here we go. Cheryl in Louisville has issued an SOS. Her files are taking over her home. She wants to know how long she needs to keep her investment and bank files.
Oh, Cheryl, I feel for you. For your investment files, you get quarterly statements. At the end of the year, you get an annual statement. Compare those quarterly statements to your annual statement. Then you can chuck the quarterlies, keep the annual statements forever. As far as your bank files, a lot of them you can chuck at the end of the year. And by the way, one extra thing, I want to throw it in there. She didn't ask about it, but your tax returns, keep them forever.
Forever?
Forever. I mean, what are you going to have? 50 tax returns?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not going to take up much space. But I knew a man, the Social Security said, you didn't work for several years. And he said, I've worked all my life. And they said, no, you didn't. He said, oh, yes, I did. And guess what he pulled out? His tax returns.
Ah, his tax returns. Okay.
So, keep those tax returns.
All right. Well, speaking of investments, Emily in Venice, California is looking for unbiased financial planning advice. Where can she find that?
All right. First of all, I like independent advisors. I like fee-only independent advisors. So what I'm paying them for is their knowledge, a blueprint, an overall guideline. What I don't want to pay them for is, hey, by the way, if you buy this mutual fund, oh, yeah, I get a commission from that. So I don't like that kind of advice.
Okay.
So I have two websites to go for. One is fpanet.org. That's the Financial Planning Association. And there you'll find certified financial planners, important designation. And it tells you this person's educated and they're doing ongoing education. There's also the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, NAPFA.org. We'll have this on our website, so you don't need to pull over to the side of the road and jot this down. But again, those are the fee-only financial advisors, so you can look in your area.
All right. Just a couple more minutes, so I'm going to take a drink here.
So am I. Whew.
All right. Here we go. Question number three, we're going to head on over to Mary in Margaretville, New York. She wants to know, do 529 accounts stand in the way of her grandchildren getting financial aid when they go to college?
All right, that could actually end up being a fairly complicated answer because it depends if you go to a private school, you go to a public school. And, you know, I always had this back of my mind, you're talking about probably 10, 12 years. Who knows what the law is going to be? My bottom line is, it's a good way to save for your child or your grandchild, because you give them choice. And we all know when you look at the price of a college education, public or private, it's daunting. And what financial aid means today, it's not grants, it's loans.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to borrow less. So absolutely go ahead and save. And if it does turn out that you have a wonderful athlete or a great musician, hey, well, we could always figure out something to add to our education over time. But that's a situation we'd all like to be in.
All right. 2 minutes to go, so let's go to question number four. We're heading over to Idaho, and Maley has a question about credit cards. We get a whole lot of those. And she wants to know when you should close credit card accounts. She has a few open that she never uses.
Okay. It's the wacky, crazy world of credit scoring and credit reports. Because the advice is, look, you don't want to close these. You've heard this. You don't want to close these because it can have a negative impact on your credit score. Now, most of us who have common sense would say, hey, if I'm not using these things, when I close them? All right. I go with the common sense world. Close them. What you want to do, however, is if you're facing a big purchase, you're going to buy a home, you're going to buy a car, you don't want to close the accounts then. Okay. Just leave it alone. But once you made that big purchase, go ahead, close the account, because you know what really matters? You borrow, you pay it off. You borrow, you pay it off. And in an era of identity theft, I say close those accounts.
And in fact, sometimes can't it hurt your credit score if you have too many open accounts? Because then you have these balances that you could run up credit to.
Exactly. So you know what? Just get rid of them.
All right. And our final question, big exhale here. Chris, here's something a lot of people ask. If you get a big chunk of money, should you pay down your mortgage or invest that money in the stock market?
Now, what people want to hear is pay off the mortgage, because all of us deep inside us, we want to say goodbye to the bank forever. We want to own our piece of the American dream. For most people, people listening to this program, it makes more sense to put the money in the stock market. For one thing, even though it's hard to believe after this recent run-up that we've had, I know the real estate market's weak now, but over time, stocks outperform residential real estate. That's one thing. But the bigger point is my favorite word, diversification. You want to have a diversified portfolio. Most of us have too much of our wealth tied in one asset, in one locality, and that's our home. So I say, build a diversified portfolio, put the money in stocks.
Fires out of the corner.
We did it, Chris. Yay! Talk about burning a lot of financial calories. Well, if you're looking to get in better financial shape, give us a call. We'll turn you into a lean, mean saving machine. Right, Chris?
I'll say whoo!
Right. Well, give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, let's hit the phones again. And, you know, Chris, a lot of people have artwork displayed around their office, but I doubt it's better than our next caller's workplace. Let's go to Darren in Boulder, Colorado. Hi, Darren.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're doing great. And I understand you're an art museum coordinator.
Well, it's the art museum. It's the CU Art Museum at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Yeah, I love it.
Most people who work in the nonprofit arena do it because they love it and not for the salary.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
And that is your situation as well?
That is my situation. It definitely is. I am 25 and my credit is, it's fine. I don't have very much of it. Most of it is like credit cards I applied to, you know, just to get a free t-shirt and then canceled. but here I am in the career I want to be in. I also want to go back to graduate school and all at once buy a place so that I feel like I'm not throwing my money away.
So you're renting right now?
I am renting, yes.
Yeah. That's a whole lot of financial burden that you're looking to take on at 25. So, Chris, what would be her first step if she's looking to get into the housing market at this point while she's looking at possibly going to grad school this year as well?
Well, at this point, what I would do is focus on the grad school, because that's going to be a big investment. Okay. And that's going to have a lot of implications for where you're going to be living, what kind of income you can expect in the future. Okay. Getting a graduate education is that's you're taking out a mortgage on your brain and your earnings ability. And so I would first focus on that before I would take on the obligation of a home.
So, Darren, are you looking at a house or a condo, or do you want to buy an apartment?
It would be a condo, and, I mean, it is Boulder, Colorado, where the housing market, although it's at a low right now, is still very high for me. So I can say that I want to be in Boulder for the next 5 years, so I feel like I could invest that amount of time in a property. I don't just want to, like, flip it.
To my mind, 5 years is sort of the tipping point in this calculation.
Okay.
3 years and under is too short of a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
With all the, you know, the jargon term is transaction costs that go with buying a home. You know, just all the fees that you have to pay to take out the mortgage and the moving expenses and all of that that goes into buying a condo.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think I still would say graduate school first, and let's figure out that investment.
Hey, what are you hoping to study in grad school?
I actually am thinking along the lines of urban and regional planning.
Urban and regional planning. Well, that's quite a leap from art, isn't it?
It's all in there together. I want the arts to be a huge part of how things are organized around
here. Interesting.
So, yeah. Well, it's abstract, but I want to pull it together.
Well, good luck with that. Hey,
thank you very much.
And good luck with grad school and possibly finding a little bit a nice little place to live down the line.
Thank you so much for your help.
All right. Well, that is all the questions that we can take for this week's show. Please leave your questions for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or you can visit our contact page on the website, marketplace.org. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks, Tess.
Small businesses face a big problem making sure their workers get health insurance, and the price is not right.
If you run a small business and you get rated just based on yourself or a few other employees, you may be out of luck finding affordable insurance at all.
And life after 60, what to call a second career in retirement. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Veglund. If you own or want to own a small business and are planning to provide health insurance, beware of the triple whammy. Small businesses pay more from the start for health insurance. Their premiums go up faster. And all that hinges on being able to get the insurance in the first place. So what's a small business person to do? We wish we had a great answer for that. But Steve Tripoli at the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk can at least tell you what you're up against.
I've been watching one small business's health insurance struggles for years. Following them over time makes you realize just how big a headache this struggle can be.
This is the largest of the units that we make. It's a portable wind choice.
Lincoln Precision Machining outside Boston makes hoists and winches for lifting things. The company struggles with costs and competition, but it's holding its own for now. When I first visited in 1999, Lincoln had 26 employees. Health insurance coverage for a family cost $460 a month back then, and the company paid for all of it. Today, Lincoln's down to 22 workers, and family health insurance premiums have tripled to nearly $1,500 a month. And workers have to pony up a share now, about $300 a month. Wages, profits, and even suppliers have been pinched to pay the bill. On the shop floor, longtime employee Rich Perduta says workers are resigned to both smaller raises and paying part of the insurance tax.
It's a tough pill to swallow, but, you know, you don't really have any control over it. You know, I mean, the company's had to pay a lot more also, so what are you really going to do?
Believe it or not, Lincoln isn't far from typical. Since 1999, small business health insurance premiums have risen about 125% nationally. That's less than Lincoln's 200%, but the company's aging workforce makes for extra-large premium hikes. Many small businesses face that. John Arensmeyer, who heads the advocacy group Small Business Majority, says small employers take an oversized health insurance hit in ways beyond price.
The bigger problem is that many, many small business people don't have access to affordable insurance. If you run a small business and you get rated just based on yourself or a few other employees, you may be out of luck finding affordable insurance at all.
Despite these common problems, the small business community is widely divided over a fix. Gary Claxton at the Kaiser Family Foundation says small businesses split among those that provide insurance and those that don't provide it or that oppose potential insurance mandates for business. Claxton sees national momentum toward broad-based plans where more businesses share the burden of insurance costs. Massachusetts and California are trying that route. But he warns that small business support for such plans can quickly erode in the face of government mandates.
When you get into the details, that broader support tends to get a little more shallow. And it is generally true that small businesses are not very trusting of government to come in and make a marketplace better.
But that's not always true. Back in 1999, I spoke with Richard Hallin at Lincoln Machining, and he's still the company's vice president. Hallin said back then that the country should eventually adopt universal health insurance, not a common view among executives. He predicted it would emerge as the best option after 8 or 10 years of hard fighting among interest groups. Well, he was wrong about the timing for universal coverage, but today he's sticking with his prediction of a national plan someday.
I don't see a real rational or a real likely alternative to that.
John Arensmeyer at Small Business Majority doesn't see so-called single-payer national insurance as the only option, but he says small businesses need some system that guarantees access to affordable health insurance.
And if part of that system involves businesses paying a fair share, we think that's perfectly reasonable. If the society decides that the solution is a single-payer system, well, then that's another way to go.
Of course, that position is directly at odds with many other small business groups. And look around. Big business, labor, and others have their own divisions, which should help you understand why major health care reform has been so elusive, even with all the big price hikes. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement and by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over 1 billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
This week, the Labor Department reported that companies added 132,000 jobs last month. Most of the growth occurred in the fields of education, health services, and leisure. So baby boomers, take note. Your leisure time during retirement might mean working in the leisure industry. Mark Friedman is the author of the new book, Encore, Finding Work That Matters in the Second Half of Life. And Mark, let's actually start with how we define that second half.
Phrases like the young old have emerged, or other oxymorons like working in retirement. Mm-hmm. So you've got this extended period of time, a population explosion of people entering that period. What happens to these boomers in this new stage of life is so important.
And what about the financial aspect of this? Because the traditional model has been, you know, you hit 60, 62, 65, and you're essentially done with your working career, and you have hopefully saved up enough money for that to be able to happen. What's the new paradigm?
Well, we've had a 50-year deal in this country, which is essentially animated by the idea of the freedom from work. When you reached a certain point, your reward for putting in all those years at the grindstone would be that you wouldn't have to work anymore. That became a version of the American dream.
As long as you saved enough.
As long as you saved enough.
Or had a pension.
And because we were trying to get people out of the labor force at a time when there were big labor surpluses, we gave people incentives to leave early. But now many people are wringing their hands and saying, we can't afford tens of millions of people spending a third of their life in subsidized leisure. We need to get people to work longer. And you're starting to see the beginning of a new deal, which is saying to people, if you will work longer, not just a year or two, but put in another phase of work, we'll make it worth your while.
So how do we make it worth their while?
We say to them, if you're willing to work longer, we'll meet you halfway. We'll help provide financial incentives to doing so, but we'll also provide better pathways, a new kind of higher education, which can help people retool for this period of life. And I think we're also going to need to give people a break. We need a national sabbatical. People are working so hard in the middle years that they don't have time to catch their breath or to even think about what they're going to do in this new period of work that could be as long as their earlier career.
Interesting. How much of this is driven by the fact that baby boomer retirees, or shall we call them encore people, have famously not saved enough for retirement, and it's become almost a necessity, if not a desire, to continue working beyond that 55, 60, 65 age bracket.
It is a necessity, and the question is, can we make a virtue out of that necessity, a genuine virtue? Mm-hmm. Because a set of conditions are lining up where individuals' personal financial circumstances, the fiscal situation of the society, labor shortages that are opening up, and also an accumulation of evidence that continued working lives actually benefits health and longevity are all driving towards this big change.
Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
49.
And have you given any thought to what you want to do in your encore career?
You know, I hadn't before I started doing this book, and I'd always thought I'd have one career and I'd extend it as long as possible. But when I saw people who had managed to find a second calling, it made me look forward to this future where I might be able to apply my talents in a way that's distinct from the opportunities I've had up to this point. And in particular, I'd like to do international work. I've always been somebody who's focused on the United States. I studied American history when I was in college. And I now realize that there's more than one opportunity to make a contribution to the world, to use one's experience, and to find new meaning.
Mark Friedman is the author of Encore, Finding Work That Matters in the Second Half of Life. Thanks for coming in, and although you're still quite a ways from it, good luck in your encore years.
Thank you, Tess. It's a pleasure.
And you can find a link to Mark's book on our website, marketplace.org. While you're there, let us know your definition of life after 60. Just click on Contact. Now time for your feedback on the show. 2 weeks ago, we ran a story from Ashley Milne-Tite about new steps collection agencies were taking to collect. We asked for your stories and heard from Michael Halfley of Indianapolis, Indiana. He got a new business cell phone 9 months ago. I'm constantly interrupted with collection agencies, he writes, because the previous owner of my number has gone into default. Most of the time, I'm deluged with automated calls and can't even talk to someone to let them know that this is a business phone. You would think that they would know that someone in default cannot get a cell phone. Yeah, you'd think. John Wiederholt listens to us in Brighton, Massachusetts. He wants even more nitty-gritty from our engaged couple, who've already told us their salaries, what they've saved, and how they manage their bank accounts. But John has good reason. He's getting hitched October 21st.
My fiancé and I have enjoyed the Engage series as we are walking in the same shoes. We were wildly disappointed to hear that the couple did not know the expected costs of their wedding. They suspected the cost would be around $10,000. However, this amount seems a little too breezy given our recent wedding planning experience. I suggest a post-wedding interview with the parents to comment on the full costs of the wedding when all is said and done. I would wager that the total amount spent would be closer to the ridiculous average amount spent on American weddings. Please bring us closure for purposes of commiseration.
John, we'll check with Tiffany's parents, but they never agreed to let us in on their finances. Lauren Goldberg is a special ed teacher in Louisville, Kentucky. She heard a recent mailbag segment and wanted to share her own story.
A man called the show wondering how he should save for his daughter's higher education. Since she was recently diagnosed with apraxia, a neurological disorder, he is not certain how much schooling she will be able to complete. The caller should certainly plan for his daughter's college education. In fact, I work at a school here in Louisville that serves many children with this disorder. Their success stories are bold and inspiring.
And finally, not all of you think we're as, like, totally awesome as we think we are. C. Roberts of Billings, Montana, wrote in to say, your program is way too overproduced, too slick, gimmicky, too much music, too cutesy, like a girl's show on finances. Your program could be extremely informative, but instead is simply too breezy for a serious listener. Tess Vigeland appears to adore the sound of her own voice. She could almost be a caricature on Saturday Night Live. Please, get serious.
Well, isn't that special?
Send us your comments, compliments, and critiques. Visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on Contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts
is
say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, you know, it seems like there's a big takeover deal on Wall Street just about every day these days.
Yeah.
And most of them are by private equity firms. Why is this happening?
These firms, their main business is to take public companies private. The rate that they're going, the New York Stock Exchange could disappear because maybe there won't be any public companies left in a few years. Imagine that.
Yikes. The managers of these firms are making these staggering sums of money. I saw one figure that says that the average compensation for the top 25 private equity managers was almost $600 million a year. I could live on that. But here's the kicker. They pay very little tax. How is that possible?
They're the richest workers in the world, but pay lower taxes than the average worker. They transform part of their compensation from high-taxed ordinary income into low-taxed capital gains.
Hmm.
And it's not just private equity. Some other turbocharged investment funds like, you know, the hedge funds play the same game. Here's a straight story. The loophole is bad tax law and bad public policy. Close it now.
How is it that they don't have to pay the same kind of taxes that the rest of us do?
Okay, let's look at the private equity firms. They make money two ways. One, they charge a 2% management fee. And then they have another fee, which is they get a 20% fee on profits. And they say that this is part of risk money, entrepreneurial money. So rather than pay the 35% ordinary income tax rate, because remember, these are workers that are going to be charged the highest tax rate,
right,
it's capital gains, 15%. So now imagine if you're taking a big chunk of your compensation, and instead of paying 35%, you pay 15%. Now that's what I call a deal. So that's the main upset. There's a second upset.
Okay.
Can I give you the second one?
Absolutely.
All right.
Because I still think this is really unfair.
It is. And the International Herald Tribune gave a good example. Goldman Sachs, most profitable Wall Street firm last year. So they paid a 32% corporate tax rate. Now, Blackstone Group, which is a legendary private equity firm.
And which, by the way, went public a couple of weeks ago.
That's right. And they paid 1.3% tax rate.
1.3%?
1.3%. Now, what this has to do is that because the law is written, a private equity firm can go public but retain its partnership structure, and therefore it pays a much lower tax rate than a corporation. So there's also a movement to shut down that loophole. But the one that really has people upset is this compensation, highly paid people, able to turn their ordinary income into capital gains.
I suppose that somebody here should play devil's advocate, and I really would like it not to be me, but I'm going to anyway, which is that, you know, these private equity types and their defenders say that the earnings aren't like a typical salary, but it's more like a return on investment, which is where you get the whole capital gains notion. But how can they say that this is not regular earnings?
The private equity lobbyists are wandering around Washington, D.C., and they're giving interviews, and they're saying, this is not about the wealthy. This
no,
is
of course
not
it's
about
not.
The rich people. This is about the average worker in blue jeans. That's
what?
Who we're really concerned about. And the reason is because if you raise this tax, which is really not raising a tax, you're just treating it the way it should be treated,
uh-huh.
you know, it's going to lower the returns, and the average worker's pension fund is not going to do as well, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that is truly nonsense.
So they're actually talking about this on Capitol Hill right now. What are the proposed solutions? Just simply close that loophole?
There are two proposed solutions. One is looking at the broader issue about compensation that we've been talking about, closing the loophole and saying, look, it's going to be taxed 35%, get used to it, adjust people. And the other one has to deal with the difference in taxation between a partnership that is publicly traded and a publicly traded corporation, so at least they're taxed similarly rather than having this big gap between that you have right now between a Goldman Sachs and a Blackstone.
The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks for managing our financial education equity.
Hey, and I'd pay 35% for that.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, reading the real estate tea leaves.
If you go by and you go to an open house and they talk about how you can get all these extras thrown in for free, you know that you as a buyer are still in the driver's seat.
Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes and Nancy Fargali with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. See you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.